This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
In time like these, brings out anew. Another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You might have loved.
Hello, and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we bring you stories past and present about health, the economy, and education in the mountains. We begin with four pieces from the Ohio Valley Resource. The first two focus on health, and the second two on the economy. Neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, is the result of severe in utero drug exposure. It has hit the Ohio Valley hard, with more than 16,000 babies affected over the past 5 years in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. OVR reporter Aaron Payne brings us a story on experts studying the long-term effects of opioid use on prenatal exposure.
The opioid crisis is hitting a new generation in the Ohio Valley, with thousands of babies born affected by drugs in the womb. Doctors call it neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS. Now researchers are looking for the long-term effects NAS has as children grow. As Aaron Payne reports, the research could help parents, schools, and communities meet a new challenge.
Sue Meeks has worked with children for years as a registered nurse. Several years ago, she started noticing children coming into the Family Navigator program she manages at Ohio University with certain distinctive behaviors.
Children that appear to be neurologically very overstimulated.
These 3 to 5 year olds were not easily calmed. They did not respond typically to laughter or reading and showed developmental delays in language and motor skills. The common denominator, exposure to drugs in the womb. Neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, has hit the Ohio Valley hard, with more than 16,000 babies affected over the past 5 years. West Virginia, for example, has one of the highest rates in the nation, with more than 5% of babies born diagnosed with NAS in just 2017. And Meek says experts aren't sure what will happen to these children as they get older.
It's a multi-pronged mystery that I'm not sure that we will ever totally solve.
Ohio University and Nationwide Children's Hospital operate an NAS clinic in Athens to research how often NAS causes long-term effects. And researchers hope to figure out the long-term effects as this generation of children enters the public school system.
Everybody knows that in the next 5 to 10 years, the school population is going to look very different.
Molly Sawyer has 20 years' experience as an educator from Montgomery County, Ohio. She is now a doctoral candidate researching long-term effects of NAS and best practices for educators to help affected students learn. Sawyer says the region's public schools might face a challenge.
We're still trying to figure out right now how are elementary-age students affected.
Sawyer is uniquely qualified to tackle this issue. She is also the parent of an adopted child exposed to opioids in the womb.
He was a great baby, but just was experiencing the world a little different as an infant and needed us to care for him and respond in a different way.
Sawyer says she draws on 6.5 years with her son and her studies to help the local school system understand these overstimulated students and what they can do.
More repetition, more time on task, more one-on-one with teachers.
Elsewhere, treatment and recovery programs work to help mother and child together. Project Hope in Huntington, West Virginia is a residential facility where mothers struggling with addiction can live with their children as they get help.
We're building healthy attachments. We're allowing mom to be there for those developmental milestones so she's not building more guilt from being disconnected.
That's Lynn O'Connell, Associate Director of Addiction Sciences for Marshall Health, which operates Project Hope. She says it's their goal to fill the gaps in care for mothers with substance use disorders. Evidence-based treatment, recovery programs, job training, housing, and parenting courses are just some of what Project Hope offers to mothers. but they also monitor children for developmental delays, and then teach mothers how to work with their babies.
Helping to strategize to meet those developmental goals, because we're not just focused on mom, but we're focused on mom as a parent.
Project Hope just opened its doors in December and is steadily growing the number of families living in the 18-apartment complex. Researchers may not know how many children will experience the long-term effects of NAS or the challenges they will face, but O'Connell says people around the Ohio Valley are dedicated to helping them overcome those challenges.
What we want to do is set those kids up for the best success. Early intervention is key.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Aaron Payne.
Next up, OVR reporter Mary Meehan brings us a story about a Mount Sterling, Kentucky vaccination company that's likely responsible for infections that have been reported throughout the Ohio Valley.
Health officials have linked a private Kentucky company to infections in clients who received vaccinations in the workplace. The company served businesses in 22 cities across the Ohio Valley. As Mary Meehan reports, infectious disease experts say it's likely the company's poor practices delivering vaccines are to blame.
Kentucky health officials say they are investigating a Mount Sterling business called Location Vaccination. Starting September 1st, Location administered vaccines to staff at other companies in Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana. University of Louisville infectious disease specialist Dr. Ruth Carrico says human error is likely the cause of the problem.
The practice or practices that were used by someone to provide care to prevent disease actually did the very opposite, and it actually resulted in patient harm. And when you look at that, this is not excusable. This should not happen.
Health officials say the infections require medical treatment and may show up as redness, pain, or swelling, or nodules at the injection site. Dr. Kosar Talat researches infectious disease at Johns Hopkins University. She says strict protocols on vaccinations make infections rare, and it is important to pin down how this happened.
Something clearly went wrong in the administration of these vaccines, and it is incumbent on public health officials to figure out what went wrong.
A spokesman for the Kentucky Department of Public Health said in an email most of the vaccines were given in a workplace, and the state is still working to find out the scope of the problem. The owners of Location Vaccination did not respond to multiple attempts for comment. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan.
From WMMT's own Sydney Bowles, our next story finds links between Pike County, Kentucky, and the murder of prominent journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia last fall.
When battery company Innerblue suspended plans for a new manufacturing facility in eastern Kentucky earlier this month, the company used a curious term to explain their decision. They blamed some, quote, unexpected geopolitical factors. Well, it turns out those factors included the Saudi Arabian government, one of the world's largest conglomerates, and the shocking murder of a journalist. Reporter Sydney Bowles connects those dots.
A former Innerblue executive says financing for the company's $372 million development in Pike County, Kentucky, hinged on a series of agreements with companies and governments around the world. The plan was this. Japanese conglomerate SoftBank, financed primarily by the Saudi Arabian government, was going to establish a massive solar array in Saudi Arabia, the world's largest, the Saudis said. To store that power, SoftBank would need batteries. Big ones. That's where American company Innerblue came in. Innerblue would supply 600 gigawatt hours of battery storage. Everything was going mostly according to plan, it seems, until on October 2nd of last year, a Saudi dissident journalist named Jamal Khashoggi walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and never walked out. Khashoggi's murder shocked the world, and pressure mounted on business leaders dealing with the Saudi government. SoftBank's CEO skipped an important investment summit in late October, and shortly after, the Saudis pulled out of the solar deal. With Saudi Arabia's solar plans with SoftBank over, SoftBank pulled out of Innerblue, and Pike County lost a chance for 875 jobs in an economically struggling part of the state. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles.
And last from OVR for this show, Liam Niemeyer brings us a piece exploring how the 2018 Farm Bill, which left hemp off the list of controlled substances, might affect Ohio Valley growers.
Hemp growers in the region hope a recent change in federal law means they can finally profit from a plant that had been in legal limbo. The latest farm bill legalized hemp, which can be used for products ranging from clothing to soap and herbal remedies. And now it's up to states to decide how to handle hemp. But as Liam Niemeyer reports, not all states in the region are ready to cash in on a hemp heyday.
Inside Winking Sun Hemp Company in Wheeling, West Virginia, the store owner Doug Flight tries to position himself in front of a camera crew.
Don't buy CBD from a vape or novelty shop.
Good, again. We weren't recording.
He's grown and sold hemp for years, but memorizing lines for what he says could be the first hemp TV commercial in the state, that's another issue.
I know, I grow. Is that it?
I know because I grow.
Isn't that the first part?
Yeah. He couldn't have done this commercial a couple months ago. Local TV stations turned him down because the federal government still classified hemp with its botanical cousin, marijuana. The 2018 Farm Bill redefined hemp as a legal crop and let states decide how to regulate it. That means farmers can buy and sell hemp and seeds from other states and advertise on TV.
If I was him, I'd make a television commercial too, because for the next 6 months to a year, my prediction is it will continue to be a very, very hot item.
That's Brian Parr, Assistant Dean of Murray State University's School of Agriculture in West Kentucky. Parr says the real money for Ohio Valley farmers is in hemp's cannabidiol, also known as CBD. Proponents claim CBD oil helps with anxiety and pain. Parr says farmers are still figuring out how to harvest CBD oil with less hand labor.
And so we've seen machines shipped in from Europe. We've seen headers from combines that are brought in that were supposed to be designed for hemp harvest that haven't worked.
Parr says investment in hemp is risky. Important measures on crop insurance are still a year away, but that hasn't stopped Ohio Valley farmers. The Kentucky Department of Agriculture approved over 1,000 hemp grower permits for 2019. That's four times more than last year. West Virginia ag officials also approved three times more grower permits. The new farm bill allows states to submit plans for regulating hemp to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner Ryan Quarles said his state was the first to file.
For 2019, Kentucky will not be sitting on its hands.
Elsewhere in the Ohio Valley, hemp growers might not get as much help from their states. In West Virginia, the Ag Commissioner says the hemp program is very underfunded. The Commissioner says West Virginia lawmakers need to give more support to its hemp program. And Ohio is one of nine states that have not passed laws to let farmers grow hemp. Ohio Farmers Union President Joe Logan says this lack of hemp infrastructure is frustrating.
Right after we got that farm bill passed, I called down to our Department of Agriculture and said, hey, listen, who's your point person on this? And they said, well, we don't have one.
Logan says he hopes that'll change this year. He says Ohio state lawmakers have not pursued hemp's potential like the rest of the Ohio Valley. And at least one eastern Kentucky farmer sees that potential to revive Appalachia's economy. Pine Mountain Remedies manager Nathan Hall doesn't have a big farm. He's growing hemp on a 2-acre plot in Letcher County, leased from local community members. He wants to make sure money from hemp goes back to struggling communities.
This is a really good opportunity to engage a lot of people who really need the income and who also have access to land that isn't otherwise really being used.
He's hoping hemp can provide a way not only to make money, but to grow stronger communities. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
We wrap up this episode of Mountain News with the fourth in a 6-part series from Michael and Carrie Klein, exploring race and class in Mount Hope, West Virginia in the 1960s. In this segment, Willie Ben Pritchett, an honors student, football and track star, and Glee Club member, discusses the educational obstacles faced by Black students who graduated from Mount Hope High School in the 60s.
Do you want peace? Do you want to be right? Do you want love? Do you want to fight? Do you want to celebrate? Or would you rather have an altercation? Do you want to build? Or do you want to tear down?
And now, Hope, wit and wisdom on race, class, and community survival, brought to you by Talking Across the Lines, the Mountain of Hope organization in Mount Hope, West Virginia, and by the West Virginia Humanities Council. Based on coalfield memories, the ones that tear you up and the ones that feed your soul. Willie Ben Pritchett, a frequent visitor here on the corner of race and class, told us he was raised up on the poor side of Mount Hope, West Virginia, in the heart of the New River coalfields. His mother, with an eighth grade education in a segregated black one-room school, cleaned houses for white people. His father, with a fifth grade education, was a coal miner. Both parents were products of a separate but equal school system, which was far more separate than it was equal. They had little idea of how to guide their son in pursuing higher education, following his very successful career at Mount Hope High School.
We had several people with 4.0 GPAs and couldn't get our foot in school anymore. They were black. They graduated with straight 4.0 GPAs and couldn't get in school nowhere.
He just finished high school, an athlete, a star, and he prayed for a job, Lord, wherever you are. A place where a black man could make him a start. He could spell, he could cipher, he knew he was smart.
In the mid-1960s, with the coal industry in decline and coal miners losing their jobs, Willie Benn, along with his fellow black students, had few prospects for remaining in West Virginia. Their 1964 graduation ceremony, with tasseled caps tossed high in the air, wound up just in time for them to crowd onto the last eastbound train out of town.
I had an uncle that lived in Washington, D.C., and when I threw that cap up in the air at graduation, before it hit the ground, I was on that train. And the train was so crowded, we had to stand up on the caboose on the outside all the way to D.C. from here. If we had to fall off, we're going to crowd on this train, you know. It was just like when you look on TV now and you see them trains in India and somewhere, you know, with people hanging all over the top of the train. That's the way we were, getting out of here.
Willie Benn Pritchett, he cut himself loose. So he's pressed against bodies hanging off a caboose. His dad was a miner, his mother a maid. So he's headed out for to find him a trade.
Well, you didn't want to spend another day here. You wanted to get out. My uncle was at the train station to pick me up, and I went and stayed with them for a while. They were living in Southeast Washington, D.C.
Also on the train were many newly graduated young black women who had not found their way into higher education, but qualified for an employment opportunity with the federal government.
The Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C. had a program where they would get these girls from these schools. They brought them up to D.C., had them a job when they got there, had them an apartment, and they went to work with the Department of Agriculture. All the women went to the Department of Agriculture. The government had that fund for them, you know, because you weren't going to school. And all the black men were getting drafted, going into the military.
Most of them resolutely faced the draft and service in Vietnam. But even that door was closed to Willie Benn.
When I graduated, I wasn't quite 18, so I couldn't get drafted then, you know. So when you got 18, you had to go and get your draft card. I wanted to go to the military so bad because all my friends were going, got drafted, and were going to the military. And I wanted to go, and they wouldn't let me go. They classified me as a 4F. I got a hole in my heart and flat feet. I tried every branch of the military, trying to get in. They wouldn't let me in. They wouldn't even let me ring the bell for the Salvation Army. I was so mad, you know. They wouldn't let me ring the bell, you know. They told me the only way that I could get in the military is that a foreign country had to be fighting on American soil. That's the only way I could get into the military. And I cried like a baby. Everybody was going to Vietnam. I wanted to go too. Maybe it was a good thing I didn't. You know, I don't know, you know. People didn't make it back. lot of people made it back and not in good shape, you know. But I wanted to go because all the rest of my friends were going, and it sounded like the right thing to do, you know, go to fight for your country, you know. And as a young black male, you didn't have a choice. I mean, you couldn't further your education because there was no opportunity. My parents didn't own a home. They didn't own nothing, you know, that they could put up, you know, collateral for me to go to school. But barely able to put food on your plate, you know. So there was not a lot of resources for black people at the time. You didn't even know people with knowledge to show you even how to apply to a college. I mean, I'm from here in Mount Hope. I hadn't been no further than Beckley in all my life. So that's the furthest I'd ever been. That's 13 miles away, you know. And I didn't even know where West Virginia State University was. I knew where Tech was because we played football at Montgomery down there. I knew Tech was right down the hill from it. But that's the only college I even thought about knowing where it was. I know I didn't know how to apply for one. And you had no counseling from the school, you know, from the teachers or anything. They weren't going to stick their neck out for you or even give you the information that you needed. And I don't think it was deliberate. We didn't know what to ask for. Sometimes you got to know what to ask for. We didn't know what to ask for. Because I didn't. And then most of the black people came out of my class and went on to school. And their parents before them had went to school, or their sisters or brothers or something before they went to school, so they knew the process. Most of us, we had no idea what the process was. And no idea that you can even think about going to college. You know, we thought, I thought at least, you know, that good grades and everything, you know, would get you into a college. It didn't work that way for black people. People that 4.0 GPAs, valedictorians of that class, didn't get nowhere. Now, as far as formal education, then a couple of periods in my life, I was homeless, you know, so I lived on the street. But I refused to come back home. I'm going to make it. I'm going to stay up here and make it. You know, some kind of way I'm going to make it. So I did. And I eventually did okay.
You know the sun going to shine in my back door someday.
To me, it's a thing of giving back. You know, I mean, somebody helped me. So whatever I have, I'm willing to share. When I first went to D.C., after I got my first apartment, I was sent back down here for people. I was sending them a train ticket to come up and live with me, pay no rent, and then they would stay with me for 6 months, get themselves together, get them a job. After they had the job for 6 months, they'd save their money, then they'd get out and I'd send for somebody else. And that's what I did. I did it with three people like that. You know, and of course, it was just like somebody had did something for me. So now I gotta reach back and try to help somebody. I'm from here in Mount Hope, you know. When they say it takes a village to raise a child, it took this whole town to raise me and to keep me out of trouble. And I knew then I wasn't gonna disappoint nobody. But the whole town raised me, black and white.
Do you want peace? Peace, peace. Do you want love? Love, love. Do you want joy? Joy, joy, joy to shower you from above.
You've been listening to highlights from the life story of Willie Ben Pritchett, Mount Hope High School class of 1964, and now active with the Mountain of Hope organization in Mount Hope, West Virginia. This program was recorded, written, and produced by Talking Across the Lines, LLC, with support from the Mountain of Hope organization and the West Virginia Humanities Council. Executive producers are Reverend Charles McKinney and Jack Spadaro. Our Hope theme song, Do You Want Peace?, was composed and sung by Laura Sandage and Friends on her Bloom CD. The song, Train from Mount Hope, was written and performed by Carrie Klein. Additional music was performed by Nat Reese on Augusta Heritage Recordings, courtesy of the Augusta Heritage Center at Davis and Elkins College. This project is presented with financial assistance from the West Virginia Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations do not necessarily represent those of the West Virginia Humanities Council or the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Hope, I'm Carrie Klein.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News, featuring stories past and present about health, the economy, and education in the mountains. Music on this episode featured Earl Gilmore with It Is No Secret off the album From the Depths of My Soul, which was recorded by Appleshop's own June Apple Recordings. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org or find Mountain News as a podcast on SoundCloud or Stitcher. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
Be not disheartened, I'll take care of you. It's no secret what God can do. What is done?
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.